Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It is said that slavery is America's original sin. Emancipation could have been our redemption from that sin, but instead, African Americans continued to be systematically discriminated against. Race is something we have had extreme difficulty overcoming, and because of the passage of time, the complexities of race relations are often forgotten or misunderstood. With that in mind, local filmmaker, writer, and historian Fred Murphy has spent much of his career exploring those complexities, something he does in at least two recent documentary films. The American South as We Know It examines the lives and experiences of African Americans during the Jim Crow era here in Charlotte and elsewhere in the South. His latest film, The Other Side of the Coin, A Reconciliation of Sorts, looks at the same period through the eyes of white people and others, remembering their impressions and experiences during that time and later on in our history, with the goal of facilitating a common understanding to grease the wheels of reconciliation. On this last day of Black History Month, we're going to spend the hour exploring the topic of those films with the filmmaker, Fred Murphy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
He is here in our Spirit Square studio along with another historian, Tom Hanchett. Welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And yeah, I'm surrounded by historians. And Michael Webb is here.
Yeah.
He's an historical interpreter at Latta Plantation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let me start with you, Fred. I haven't had the opportunity to see either of these elusive films. But I know you've been touring the country with the first one, and the second one is either out or about to come out.
Yeah, well, we're still filming the second one.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the first one focuses, as I said, on Jim Crow.
Sure.
The other one has something to do with Jim Crow, and then it expands out into present day. Why did you decide to focus the first one on Jim Crow?
You know, as a kid, I was very intuitive with what was being said around the dinner table with my aunts and grandmothers and family reunions, hearing these things such as, remember when we could not do this or we could not do that, or we share a crop six times in one year for this specific family, or remember the date in which we left to go up north, which was Illinois, which was, you know, the great migration for African Americans out of the South, who were pretty much tired of the continued form of slavery with regards to sharecropping. So I would hear all these things, and I'm trying to figure out why. The why wasn't really given to me, as it's not given to a lot of young individuals. I think during that time, maybe it was to protect them, because, you know, it's hurtful. You know, we paid the price, so you don't have to. Or it could have been just stay out of grown folks' business, right? It could have been either or. But it was very interesting to me. So as I got of age, I started researching a whole lot more of it. And I wanted to go around in the South, and I did, Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina. And I feel like I'm missing a state. And I was able to initially start this as an oral history project. But I said, you know, this is a very visual society in which we live in. So I'm not sure if the oral history project would gain as much attention.
But it can still be an oral history project with pictures.
With pictures, absolutely. Yeah, sure. But then there was something in me that was just, I just kept hearing, we've done more so you can do more. Mm-hmm. So I went and purchased a camera, and I got a student from a recent graduate from Johnson C. Smith University. His name is Andrew Smith, who has a production company called Nova Initia. And we toured the South interviewing individuals.
The Oscar-winning Best Picture of the Year was Green Book, which is about this period in our history. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it.
Okay, I was going to ask if you thought it was a good representation of that period.
However, real quick, I am going to be there's a hotel called the Imperial that's in Thomasville, Georgia, and I am in talks with them with the Thomas Hadley Museum, and I'll be screening The American South as We Know It, and the proceeds of that will be going to them renovating the hotel that was in that was identified in that Green Book.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the first film focuses on African Americans and their memories and their experiences and their feelings about Jim Crow. The second expands that out, but it focuses on whites and Native Americans and immigrants and other people.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to segregate that out?
You know, oftentimes after I screen the first documentary, I have whites that come up to me and say, hey, you know what? I was part of the problem. Everything that I seen, everything that I saw in your documentary, I perpetuated that.
And these are older people?
Yeah. Some are older and some are in their 50s and 60s.
Okay.
You know, I guess it just depends on what we define old, right? I don't want to offend anybody.
Watch it, yeah.
Right. I need to watch it. But they said, you know, and I'm this age now and I really don't care what people say about me anymore. My father has passed. My mother has gone, or my grandparents are here anymore to kind of govern what it is that I say or my behavior. So I'm willing to talk about it. So I said, you know, the idea went off in my head. I said, well, this can be a great documentary. This could be a part two, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And I sat in the homes of individuals who flat out came out and said, you know what, I was racist. Everything that I did caused harm to individuals, and I want to reconcile in some way, shape, or form.
Wow.
Or there were individuals that I've interviewed, specifically Susan Marshall, I remember, specifically her story. And she went to the Women's College, I believe, it was in Greensboro. In Greensboro.
Bennett.
And it was a college that was right up the street from Bennett.
Okay.
She's a Caucasian lady.
Okay.
And but she was involved with the protests and things there in Greensboro. But she said she was an individual that never believed in segregation. She's always fought for the side of equality and equity. So it's these rich experiences and stories that I hope allow individuals to identify what is needed as far as reconciliation.
So, Tom, I said at the beginning that race relations in this country are incredibly complex. They're often for the reasons we do things, the attitudes that we sometimes carry around. We don't even understand why we have those attitudes, where they came from. They were probably passed down from previous generations. So let's frame that time period. Let's put Jim Crow in a place in time. When was it? Most people who were alive, obviously, as long as you and I have been alive, no. But there are about a bunch of young people who have no idea what we're talking about here. When was this?
Right. Well, Jim Crow was a minstrel show character, and he was always happy. He was always dancing.
I was going to ask you why it's called Jim Crow.
And he was a stock character, and that character became really popular on stage and screen, probably not screen back then.
And but, was that character played by an African-American, or was it a white guy?
Often by a white person in blackface.
Okay.
Yep.
But the happiness and the happy-go-luckiness was the point of the character, and the laws are the absolute opposite of that, and it's a genius naming situation.
Who created the character? Was it the white entrepreneur that
Yes.
ran the minstrel show?
Yes.
And the purpose of creating that character as this happy-go-lucky, the world is great to me, is to deflate or to deflect from the truth of the situation?
The character was an entertainment piece, but yes, I think so.
So the whole era became known as Jim Crow. Why?
The laws tightened down not right after the Civil War,
right,
but a generation later when there's an economic downturn in the 1890s, kind of like what we've been living through recently, where the economy kind of unloads on everybody and people are looking for somebody to blame. And that is when the extreme segregation that I grew up with in the South, the separate waiting rooms in the train stations, first ones in Charlotte are in 1896. Black folks sit at the back of the streetcar, later the back of the bus, new North Carolina law, 1903. Even down at the courthouse, 1901, for the first time, there are separate white and colored Bibles to swear on in court. And that world of separation becomes geographical separation. It hadn't existed previously. There had been a tremendous intermingling, and the sense that there should be a black side of town and a white side of town really crystallizes in the first half of the 20th century. And by the time you get up into the 60s and 70s, people kind of forget that it was created. They assume that it was God-given. It had always been here. And a lot of those assumptions we still carry with
us. We're going to come back and talk a lot about how this developed and why Jim Crow developed and why we became a segregated society in a minute. Jim Crow, it was certainly particular to the South, but was it just to the South, Michael? Could you have found pockets of Jim Crow everywhere in the country?
Yeah, with my area in the field of historical interpretation, when I talk about slavery, slavery just didn't happen in the South. We have to be reminded that this country was founded off slavery. During the time of the American Revolution, maybe Dr. Hancher, you could correct me on this, New York was one of the largest slave-owning states. Absolutely. In the 13 colonies. So it just didn't happen in the South. It happened throughout this country, and the founding of this country is slavery within its own fabric.
You know, it's you as an interpreter at Latta Plantation talk about the three different categories of slaves. There's the field slave, there's the artisan slave who, I guess, fixed the wagon and shoed the horses and right. built and fixed things around the plantation, and they're the house people, the servants within the house,
yes.
who cooked the meals and served the food and cleaned the house. Were they treated differently? Were each of these classes of people or categorizations of servants, slaves, treated differently by the white slave owners? In other words, did they get to know the servants in the house and treat them as family better than they did for the people who actually grew the cotton and harvested the cotton?
Yeah, for all those points that you said, yes, they were treated differently. For an artisan, because of his skill, he was probably the only one on that plantation that knew how to blacksmith or who knew how to be a carpenter or a brick mason, even for the ones working in the house to know how to cook. They were all treated differently. For various reasons.
So when slavery ended, this is before Jim Crow, because there's a long, about, what, 40, 50 years before Jim Crow really took hold. But when slavery ended, were those people treated differently as they wandered away from the plantation and started lives of their own as free people?
That was the peculiarities, even when it came to slavery. Once Reconstruction came into play, there were some who left the plantation, and then there were others who felt like, hey, this was the only place that I knew.
It was home.
It was home. And so, of course, the former slave owners said, hey, listen, I'll make this agreement known as the sharecropper's agreement, where in return I will give you my tools, I will give you the seeds to grow the fields, and I'll give you a place to stay. But in return, you have to give me a certain amount of crop each month.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? Even though they agreed upon this certain amount of crop, over time, because of inflation or the economy, sometimes things had to change for the slave owner and the sharecropper being that former enslaved person, where a couple of months down the road, you know, the slave owner or the landowner will say, listen, I know we agreed upon you giving me a certain amount of crop for your payment, but listen, because of the economy, I may need you to give me more.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, it becomes this systemic issue where now you're indebted to me.
Right.
And it becomes another form of slavery.
But was that deliberate? Was that deliberate? Part of some, at least?
For some, yes. For others, no.
Okay. Fred.
And when we look at the 19th century, when we look at the Black Codes, there were so many things that were put in place to continue the oppression of African Americans. When we talk about individuals, when we talk about poll taxes, when we talk about literacy tests, when we talk about the grandfather clause and things like that, these things were put in place intentionally to marginalize African Americans' ability to have autonomy over movement, over their communities, et cetera, et cetera. So I would dare say that after the emancipation of slavery, individuals that were working in the house and that were artisans, et cetera, things kind of leveled out because they all had to go through the same hoops of trying to get to gain some type of leverage in their lives with trying to create these new lives that they didn't know before.
That's Fred Murphy, filmmaker, historian. The film is called The American South as We Know It. The other side of the coin is the other one. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Fred Murphy is with us. He's a filmmaker and historian. His two films are called The American South as We Know It, which focuses on the experiences, memories, and attitudes of African Americans during the period of Jim Crow. The Other Side of the Coin, A Reconciliation of Sorts, takes a look at white people, indigenous Americans, immigrants and others, talking about their racial experiences or their racial interactions, shall we say. You have said, Tom, that segregation had to be invented because following the Emancipation Proclamation and the freeing of the slaves and the end of the Civil War, not only did African Americans become free individuals to make their way in the world as they saw fit, although they sometimes had lesser success with it than others because of sharecropping and the things that we just talked about with Michael Webb, they were able to live side by side with white people. It was no big deal, correct?
That's true. About 30 years, there's this kind of window of opportunity where African Americans coming out of slavery, many of the leaders are artisans. There's a guy here in Charlotte, William Hauser, who was born an enslaved person in 1847, came to Charlotte after the Civil War. His trade was making bricks. Pretty soon he had a brickyard. He owned property where bricks were made. He invested in a steam-powered brick-making plant. He had teams of artisans who went out and built stuff. About half the buildings, I just found this last weekend. I've been tracking this guy for years, and I found a piece about him that about half of the buildings in the Charlotte area, out as far as Hendersonville, were built by William Hauser.
I forgot to do the reset coming out of the break, which means I forgot to say who you are. Tom Hanchett is an historian. Fred Murphy's the filmmaker we're talking to. Michael Webb's an historic interpreter at Ladder Plantation. I've also forgotten to tell people they can join this conversation. I'm completely discombobulated today. You can join us by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, searching for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us, by gosh, on Facebook Live. In your book, Tom, Sorting the New South City, Race, Class, and Urban Development in Charlotte, 1875 to 1975, you say that in the decades following the Civil War, Charlotte had no hard-edged black neighborhoods. Rather, African Americans continued to live all over the city, usually side by side with whites. And this was not peculiar or particular to Charlotte. This happened everywhere.
That's true.
Something changed, and you've alluded to this, at the turn of the century. Some have said the Industrial Revolution brought this change. Others have said economic downturn brought this change. But it would seem to me that it would take great effort to change this. If people are living side by side and suddenly someone somewhere decides, you know what, these people need to be ghettoized. They need to live by themselves over here. That's a massive movement of people. How did that happen?
The movement takes a little while, but this was a city that was growing very quickly. And so as new stuff was being built—
But this happened everywhere. This happened all over the South. It happened in the North.
And cities as a whole are growing quickly. In Charlotte, one of the key moments is when deed restrictions start to be inserted in the deeds. 1901 is the first one that says this property should be used only by members of the Caucasian race. And that's in a new streetcar suburb. The streetcars had allowed the city to break the bonds of the old walking city. And so out in places like Plaza Midwood and Dilworth, you were making it up. And as you were making it up, you inserted this new piece.
And the same thing happened as late as the end of World War II when Levittown was being built.
Right. Once the restrictions are in there, they become best practice because they're the new thing. Mm-hmm. And eventually the federal government includes a requirement that you do that if you want to get Federal Housing Administration loans.
I don't know if any of you know this, or I don't know whether it comes up in your film, because this actually predates anybody who would be alive today to be able to talk about Jim Crow. They were probably talking about the tail end of Jim Crow as opposed to the beginnings of it. But What did African Americans think about this? What did white people think about this when suddenly it was verboten for them to live together after years of living together?
Well, so, when the streetcars were segregated in 1903, the black ministers in Charlotte created a streetcar boycott, half a century before Rosa Parks and
the Montgomery Bus boycott. What was the reason given? I mean, how do you tell people suddenly You black people can't ride the streetcar, or black people have to use different water fountains, or black people can't eat in the restaurant, or black people can't use that bathroom. How do you tell them that?
During the 1890s, there's this economic downturn. There's a depression, not like the little recession we've lived through. And it may just be me, but since the recession, has there been sort of a – has politics gotten uglier? Same thing happened back then.
Well,
and
in an
there
article,
was a sort of a drumbeat of blame. African Americans are the people who are to blame for our bad situation, and we need to protect
ourselves. Sounds very familiar. In an article in The Atlantic, they write, white elites, well, this may be, I may be jumping the gun on this, but white elites cast out of power and facing policies that threatened their economic hold on the state launched a campaign that they knew would drive black and white apart. They called it a campaign of white supremacy and sought to unite whites of all economic backgrounds in hatred of black people. Why did these so-called white elites feel suddenly threatened?
Because in the early 1890s, when the Depression hit, the first reaction of Southerners was to band together black and white to change the power structure. Something called the fusion, a coming together of black and white, not all white, not the right. Economic leaders, but the great mass
of
white folks.
Well, there was a so-called fusion party or readjuster party, is that right? That in the 1890s, black Republicans and poor white people came together.
Right.
And they essentially ran for office, and they won.
And they won.
In large numbers. Yes. They defeated a lot of the power structure.
You have to imagine, remember that back then, what's now the Republican Party, what's now the Democratic Party, what they stand for was flipped.
Yeah.
But, there's a point in 1896 in North Carolina where the Republican Party, the fusion, has both houses of the state legislature and the governor's chair. And it really weirds out the men of property and standing.
So were they, when they got this power, did they do things that legitimately frightened, that looking back on it would have had a legitimately, what am I trying to say? That they were doing things that could be pointed to as being disadvantageous to those who used to hold the power?
One problem that hurt a lot of people was there was not a open credit market because it was hard to you didn't have an internet where you could play lenders off against each other back then. And so one of the things that the Fusion Party did was to have an interest rate cap that lenders could not charge more than 10% interest rate.
Right.
Well, if you're a lender, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, I think something else that's very important that we have to discuss here as well is that there were also African Americans that were fine having their small pockets of euphoria, if you will, and did not necessarily want integration. Integration was scary for them because if they were able to feel safeguarded in their own communities and not have to step out into a world in which was very unknown, and that was due to the fact that you had lynchings that were happening there, you had outright discrimination that was happening. Some African Americans never really even wanted integration. They just wanted equity.
Yeah.
They were fine in their schools. They were fine in their neighborhoods, their grocery stores. They were fine.
Would you say that was the majority or a small minority?
I think that talking with more individuals now during these the different oral history projects and things like that that I've completed in the filming, I think that is a majority.
Really?
When they sit back and they really look at it. Because look at what's happening with gentrification and everything that's happening right now.
If you flip that coin and you talk about white people who these are hard conversations.
Oh, absolutely. But you got to have.
But if you flip that coin and you talk about white people who would like to see that, who would have liked to have seen that, who would like to have seen white people living by themselves, black people living over here by themselves, maybe even let black people have equity, have equal schools and equal access to home loans and things like that, then the white person becomes a racist when they say that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a slippery slope. Yeah. It's a slippery slope. But African Americans were functioning out of fear. This was out of fear. When you wake up in the morning and you look in the newspaper and you see this person was hung, or this woman was raped, or this person was never seen again, or you see newspaper ads of individuals that were formerly enslaved saying, I've been enslaved for 20 years and I'm free now and I'm trying to find my son. This is their name, and they were sold by this person and that person and this person. This was well in the 30s, in the 1920s and 30s, where people were trying to. So it was, they were functioning out of fear and was trying to create a safe haven for themselves. And that's why they did not necessarily want integration.
So this fusion movement was successful politically, at least in North Carolina, in the legislature for a while. And they did maybe some things that legitimately frightened the white power structure. Or threatened the white power structure. But the backlash was Jim Crow. The backlash was aimed, the worst of it was aimed at African Americans. Why? Because it wasn't just African Americans that were part of this fusion movement. It was poor white people. Why were they not part of it?
One of the efforts was voter suppression. And the voter suppression included the poll tax and the grandfather clause, basically have to pay to vote.
Right.
And the other part was a so-called literacy test, which hurt a lot of people who were not very well-to-do. There had been very little public education back then. And those were sold as a way to keep African Americans away from the ballot box, but they actually hurt working-class white folks as well.
Yep.
And so voter suppression, the changing of the political access, that happens in 1900, and it continues until the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And it is not just harmful to African Americans, it's harmful to working class whites.
This is systemic, and it is systematic. Two different things, I suppose. But the Democratic-controlled newspapers of that time came out against what was referred to as Negro rule. This was back in the 1890s, early 1900s. The Charlotte Observer of that day ran an editorial stating that, quote, the Anglo-Saxon must rule. I'm sure that was not an isolated editorial. I'm sure there were articles in every white-controlled, and they were all white-controlled newspapers of the day that talked about that. Was this, it sounds like hysteria. Was it, or was there at least was it couched in a patina of reasonableness? Or do you know? You may not know the answer to that.
It sounds pretty hysterical to me when I get back into the, not hysterical funny, but
panic,
trying to incite panic. And another name for an economic downturn is a panic. And so the economic and the social and racial things are deeply intertwined.
This fear of black people, African Americans, stems back to slavery. I mean,
it definitely does.
People in the South were outnumbered by their slaves, and it often fascinates me why the slaves just didn't slit their throats and be done with it. Because you outnumbered us.
That was definitely the part, especially once Reconstruction came into being. They were fearful, and so they had to use tactics. Especially once Jim Crow came into play, after many of these African Americans were in politics as senators and other in political realms as well.
But white people knew the black people that worked for them. They knew they weren't.
Yeah, so you need a catalyst to kind of give some influence and power and sway. As far as what I mean by whites needed somebody in the community to dictate what went on in these African American communities. Once African Americans started losing power after Reconstruction, all the way up into the Jim Crow era, that's where you get these fears, because you want to keep them in control and in a certain position.
And that gives rise to the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, absolutely.
James Comey, who was on this program yesterday, the former FBI director, made reference to the fact that in the early 20th century, I think two-thirds of the United States Congress were members of the Ku Klux Klan, for crying out loud.
Sorry to interrupt, but real quick, during one of my oral history projects, I interviewed a gentleman named Carl Bubba Friedman, and he was a Jewish lawyer in Birmingham, Alabama. He was involved with getting some of the children out of jail with the Children's Crusade in Birmingham in 63. And he said, in order to get in any type of political sphere or to hold office, every person from the police chief firemen, et cetera, it was mandatory that you join the Klan. And now we know that that's not just germane to Birmingham, Alabama, yeah. Right? So you're right, and it was around during that time period. Well, of course, the 20s was the strong second rising of the Klan, which, of course, originated in Giles County, Tennessee, which is where I'm from, Pulaski County. So they had that stronghold because just imagine if you were able to have control over people of color, African-Americans, for all these years, what in the world would life look like when you do not have that control anymore? Who's going to give that up? Yeah. Why in the world would someone say we're ready to make things equal?
So you have this hysteria whipped up by the newspapers. The Ku Klux Klan reconstitutes itself. There's another thing I was going to bring up. Birth of a Nation.
Yes.
That movie.
Mm-hmm. History writ with lightning, said yes. President Woodrow Wilson.
And you have to put,
it's not history, it's propaganda.
That's right. Sure. You have to put that movie into context. This is the beginning of motion pictures. It was fascinating. It's like social media. It had to be true. It was on the screen. The pictures moved. And it was incredibly racist and hysterical. That formed a lot of people's opinions about black people for generations, that movie.
Still does.
Yes, it does. And actually, D.W. Griffith, right, who wrote The Klansman, he has origins that go back to York County, South Carolina.
Yeah.
And where he gained influence to write that book was a situation that occurred during Reconstruction. I previously worked at another site where we talk about this. There was a gentleman by the name of Jim Williams who was enslaved in York County. And sometime during the Civil War, he ran away from his plantation to join the Union Army during the Civil War. Well, when he comes back, he's in his Union blues, and he starts his own militia now with the new governor of South Carolina trying to form a militia for the African-American community. He becomes the leader. Well, the problem was the former slave owner of Jim Williams did not like all this power that he had. And this is where that stems from, the fear that we were just saying. You know, oh, my goodness, we're all going to die now that, you know, our former enslaved people are up in arms. Yeah, and you got to do something about it. And so eventually, unfortunately, they hang him.
Yeah, there are a lot of lessons to be learned here, and that can be applied to what, as you alluded to earlier, Tom, that can be applied to what is happening today with regard to the hysteria being whipped up about immigration and about the need for a wall and things like that. A lot of what is being said is, well, yes, we do have an immigration problem, but a lot of what is being said is simply not true. It's hysterical. Mm-hmm. You're not going to comment on that.
Okay. I'm a historian. I do the past. But one of the reasons that I do the past is because it helps us understand where we are.
That's my point.
This is not the first
That's
time
my point.
That some of
now
these...
stop talking because we have to go to a break. Tom Hanchett, Fred Murphy, and Michael Weber here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about experiences during Jim Crow and the move toward reconciliation and how we do it. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let me see if I can do this right this time. We're here with Fred Murphy, filmmaker, writer, historian, auteur of the American South as we know it, and the other side of the coin, a reconciliation of sorts. Tom Hanchett is here, historian, and Michael Webb, an historic interpreter at Latta Plantation. The first film, The American South as We Know It, focuses on the experiences, memories, attitudes of African Americans, who lived during Jim Crow.
Yep.
Are they angry about it still, or do they look back on that period with some bemusement?
You know, individuals that I've spoken to, a lot of them are still angry. Mm-hmm. You've limited their movement. You've limited their ability to raise their kids in an environment that is non-threatening. There were invisible lines all around you that you knew you couldn't cross.
And it was the actual treatment of individuals.
Oh, absolutely.
The way people treated them. I mean, I remember, this is an anecdote, but I remember when I moved to Columbia, South Carolina from Washington, D.C. in 1976, and I was walking down a downtown street. And it was crowded that day for some reason, because there's never anybody downtown in Columbia. But I was walking on the sidewalk, and African Americans were approaching me. They got off the sidewalk and walked in the gutter.
Sure.
And I thought, that's odd. I'd never experienced that
before. To you?
Yeah.
To them, it was every day.
So that, there is that, but there are the things that you mentioned that we don't think much about, like redlining, mm-hmm. where you couldn't get loans and you couldn't, and the deed restrictions, yeah. that you couldn't buy a house. These are the kinds of things that have long-lasting effects, and I would say are still being felt today, which is why we have this upward mobility problem mm-hmm. in Charlotte. If you're born poor here, you die poor here, and that is because nobody in that era, no African Americans in that era, were allowed to build wealth.
Yeah.
The way we are. We don't think of ourselves as wealthy necessarily, most white people, but you buy a house, you sell it for more than you paid for it. You buy the next house. You sell that for more than you pay for it. You're building wealth.
Well, not only that, but when you look at buying a house now, you know, these lots are already predetermined, right? I mean, you know, you have your lot, you know, in these communities, you know, you have these large builders that come in, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're talking about the past, we're talking about land, and individuals built their homes, right? So in 1862 was the Land Act. And I think the last person benefited from the Land Act in the 1980s, and it was in Alaska. But there's been a landlock in this country for centuries. And unfortunately, African Americans and Native Americans weren't able to take part of that because they weren't considered citizens, and they had to jump through all the same hoops that they're having to jump through now to, you know, so That's part of the issue.
And in fact, lending laws, United States government lending laws, prohibited a lot of black people from getting the kind of loans that white people got every day, even mm-hmm. if they weren't qualified for them. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah. One of the things that I show when I give talks about sorting out the New South City is the FHA lending manual from the late 1930s, which categorized racial groups in terms of their loan worthiness. And down at the bottom were Negroes and Mexicans. Yeah. And that made it really hard for an African American to own their own home. Now, some did, but my dad got a VA FHA mortgage. And when I wanted to buy my own house, he gave me a loan for part of the down payment. Yeah. That's that generational wealth accumulation. Yeah.
So there are the indignities that we all know about. Separate water fountains, separate bathrooms, not being able to eat at the lunch counters in at Woolworths or other places. This whole idea of second class citizenship, and then there are these things like redlining and that hold you back. Purpose of they're hidden; you can't see them. They're the things you could see and the things you could not see. They were all set up to discourage and defeat African Americans from succeeding. What makes people who lived through that time angrier or more resentful, if that's the right word? I'm not. You tell me how they feel about that. Which was worse for them?
Yeah, I think that some of the things in which they're seeing now. I mean, when you see a young Tamir Rice at 12 years old, within 2 seconds, when the police come up and they shoot him and they kill him,
that's a vestige. You see that as a vestige of Jim Crow.
Oh, absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. I mean,
the fact that
regardless of how old the young African-American child is, if they have a gun in their hand or what resembles to be a real gun, there's a good opportunity yeah. or good chance that you may not make it home.
The fact that you're followed through department stores, even though you could probably buy anything
sure.
in a department store, you're
absolutely.
Followed because you could be a shoplifter.
Absolutely.
Because you're black.
There's the perception. Perceptions influences behavior.
So how do you get over that? How do you get past that? We're way past the legalization of Jim Crow, but the vestiges still remain. How do you get past that?
It's a million-dollar question, man.
That's the million-dollar question. I think we need to really open Pandora's box
yeah.
and talk about past history, like what Dr. Hanchett and what, you know, Mr. Murphy is doing. We need to really sit down and have an open discussion as Americans and really explain how we feel.
When you take young people through Latta Plantation and you talk about slavery and you talk about the aftermath of slavery, I'm assuming that you do bring up some of the aftermath of slavery. Maybe you don't.
I do.
What is their reaction? Because a lot of kids, this is new information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With the new world age of technology, you know, all the information is right under their fingertips. They always want to know, you know, the abuse and the punishment that the enslaved mm-hmm. were given. And unfortunately, a lot of these incidents were never really recorded and documented. We only have anecdotal information. So I can only talk about the historical narrative of what could have occurred if an enslaved person would have gotten out of line.
Yeah, because the white owners are not going to document in their diaries, I beat Jim today because he stole a piece of candy.
No, not at all. We do have one document where one of the enslaved Peter, he runs away. And Mr. Latta puts an ad out in the Catawba Journal. And usually when they catch one of their enslaved runaways, they put another ad out to let them know that, hey, we caught them, everything's fine. Well, guess what? Mr. Latta didn't send out that reposting. So we assume that Peter ran away. So what does that tell us, though, about the conditions that are going on in Latta? It kind of only gets your imagination going as far as the conditions.
You do have to understand the history, because if you don't understand the history, you don't know why we feel and act and do things the way we do them today, and a lot of African-American history is not told. It has traditionally not been told in textbooks or in schools. A lot of people don't know that it was slaves who built the White House. Mm-hmm. Slaves built the Capitol building in Washington, and one of the people you interviewed, I saw one brief clip, Fred, of your movie, a woman points out that African-Americans built the South. She says that when people say, go back to Africa, she asks, why? We made this Africa with our blood, sweat, and tears. People don't think about that.
No, they don't.
No. What's it like to carry that awareness that your ancestors mm-hmm. built all of this? You refer to the brick guy. Built all of this.
May I interject?
Sure.
Because I get this question all the time at my job. And I get unfortunately, a lot of white Caucasian ladies asking me, why do you guys still press upon this issue of slavery? Why do y'all still want to talk about slavery? It was so long ago. Well, I tell her, since it was so long ago and we need to stop talking about it, let's stop celebrating the 4th of July. How can you not talk about something that was in the fabric of this country's history?
That still allows this country to be an economic juggernaut. Because when you look at... There's this book that's called Ebony and Ivy, and it talks about the enslaved individuals and their contributions to building prestigious colleges and universities in the country. So, I mean, let's look at the University of North Carolina, for example. You have parents that are walking up there dropping off checks, $100,000, $140,000, $50,000 for their kids to go to school. Who built majority of that campus?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. You got it for free,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the legacy and the economic advantages that this country has been able to achieve off the labor of enslaved individuals, I mean, it's infinity. It doesn't stop.
I'm reminded about it every day. Clemson University was once a plantation.
Yeah.
In the middle of campus is John C. Calhoun's plantation. Guess what?
Yeah.
This is where I come into play, because this is what got me started knowing my family history. My father's enslaved ancestors once lived and worked there.
Yeah.
Where the football stadium is located now used to be the cotton field.
Race matters for juvenile justice. They've mm-hmm. held racial equity workshops in the past. One's coming up next month in March. But following an earlier workshop, the Observer's Taylor Batten wrote a column about what he learned when he attended it. He said, here's the upshot. It's not about blaming current day whites. It's not about asking whites to give up something. It's about whites recognizing and accepting how systems, laws, and structures have benefited them and hurt people of color since before the country's founding, and that the effects persist today. Let me ask the white guy in the room. I know you're an historian, you don't talk about the present, but this is about the past. Do you think most white people recognize that, even know it?
I don't think so. There is a marvelous book called The Color of Law that is being used as a community read in many parts of Charlotte today. If you're interested in this, colorofLawCLT.org. And there are discussions about this legacy that shut people of color out of the wealth building that advantaged white folks like me. Like I said, I'm in a neighborhood that's gentrifying. I'm going to eventually sell my house for much more than I paid for it. That's because I own my house. If I was a renter, mm-hmm. my family had been shut out of ownership, I wouldn't have that benefit. And the book that I wrote called Sorting Out the New South City looks at the roots of this kind of racial segregation in Charlotte. I'll put in a plug. I'm going to be talking about that in detail this Monday, March the 4th, from 7 to 8 at the Morrison branch of the public library near South Park. This is a story that we are all embedded in, no matter what our racial background, even if we are just brand new newcomers to this country. The momentum of this history is very much with us.
And if you need proof that there are vestiges still of all of this, I can look at Fred Murphy and get that proof. And here's how. In that same article that I referred to that Taylor Batten wrote, mm-hmm. he refers to a guy, are you sitting down?
Yeah.
By the name of Deshaun Murphy. That's you, isn't it?
That's me.
You're Fred Murphy on yeah. this program. You're Fred Murphy as a filmmaker. You're Fred Murphy in your day job. Why?
That's a tough question.
I have an answer. I don't know if it's the accurate answer.
I
always know the answers to the question.
Yeah, you know, I met him there, and that was a long conversation, and we talked about how African Americans, we have to be chameleons, and we have to adjust. That came about because I've gone by Deshaun Murphy my whole life up until mm-hmm. my 20s, and I was not getting callbacks for jobs. I just wasn't getting any hits. And I was at a bar in Atlanta. I was down. I was talking with a white guy, and he was like, man, you look kind of down. I said, yeah, well, there's got some things going on. And he asked, well, what's going on? So we talked, really nice guy. And he said, well, what's your name? I said, Deshaun Murphy. He said, do you have a first name or is that your middle name? And I said, that's my middle name. My first name is Frederick. He said, you have to change your name on your resume to Frederick Murphy.
Did it work?
It did. Because I got callbacks, multiple callbacks from the exact same places that I put the resumes in prior to. And I got one of the jobs at the exact same places. Same resume, everything. But that name change from Frederick, which is my father's first name, to Frederick Murphy versus Deshaun Murphy. Obviously, it sounds less ethnic. And yeah.
So as I sit here and talk to you, and you're mm-hmm. the you're the subject of my film, what went through your head when that hit you as a, and not only when he told you that,
yeah.
but when you found out that it worked, he was right.
Yeah. I was told that before and I kept fighting it. I knew I probably needed to.
Makes you angry. I can see it.
Oh,
in your
yeah,
eyes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still upset.
I can see it in your eyes.
Yeah, yeah. So I knew it before. I mean, I was told that before. People with quote unquote black names, you're not going to get a job with that black name. So
your second film mm-hmm. has an eye toward, it's not focused on African-Americans. It's focused on people of other races, but it's also brings up the question of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. How do we make steps toward reconciliation? We have so much, everybody is carrying around this baggage. Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of the baggage? What's the first step?
Well, with this documentary, when I'm going into Native American communities, and I am including African Americans as well as whites, I'm asking individuals directly, what is it that you need governments, local officials, and just this country to know as far as what do you need for reconciliation? Oftentimes, these specific entities feel like they know what's best for people that have been oppressed and marginalized.
What would reconciliation look like?
I think it's different for different people.
Yeah, I would have to concur on that one. Definitely, definitely.
And it would be different for every human being in the country. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of difference.
From the macro community, with regards to African-Americans, perhaps Natives, I can only speak for Africans, you're talking reparations. We do full-blown reparations. This country is bankrupt within seconds. Right. It's done.
But finito. I think that could be divisive, too, because then you'll have a part where people will say, why do they get something?
We don't, of course.
You know?
The complexities of being human beings.
And these are the complexities that really kind of get us in a tizzy as far as trying to reconcile and try to figure out how to mend what has not been.
Right. Awareness is part of it. Talking about it is part of it. Going to Atlanta Plantation and going to historic Rosedale, reading the books, finding about how we became us.
Tom Hanchett, historian. Michael Webb, historic interpreter at Latta Plantation. Fred Murphy, filmmaker of the American South as we know it and the other side of the coin, a reconciliation of sorts. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.